Welcome to a very special edition of the podcast. We're looking at the 25th anniversary of Madonna's Truth or Dare, a very influential documentary, preceded reality television. Madonna was very prophetic about where fame would go. So joining me are Joe Reed from Decider, Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks, and I am Nathaniel from The Film Experience. Unfortunately, there was a technical error, so we're missing the very beginning of the podcast. So we're going to jump in toward the beginning when Nick starts telling his story of the first time that he saw the movie. Enjoy.
So it was sort of funny at the I so I saw it when I was in the theater. I was 13, and it was pretty clear that I was going to have trouble getting into this movie, which I went to by myself. And I was talking the ears off of two people who were in line behind me and helping them understand what an artistic leap she had just made with Like a Prayer. Although I don't know if I'm Breathless is really as good, but well, I don't know. And it was giving them like a whole rundown and like the time I'd been Madonna for Halloween when I was in fourth grade and whatever. And
Amazing.
so eventually these people, the guy came out and was like, we're going to be enforcing the R rating really hard on this one. So just be ready to have your IDs out and stuff. And I was like, oh, and they could tell that I was all crushed. And like, well, do you want to just be like our nephew? I was like, yes. And so, what I didn't realize until a year later was that the guy who took the tickets, this is on an army base in Germany,
Of
was a guy
course.
who was in the battalion that my dad commanded, all of whom were over in the first Gulf War at this time. And he had pretended to be gay so as not to have to deploy, even though he obviously wasn't. So he thought I knew that, and he thought I was kind of lording this like commander's kid shit over him. I didn't know that until later.
What
So
intrigue, my
he
God.
knew for not my uncle and aunt. Adding to the intrigue was the fact that I was supposed to have been met there by my three friends and one of their moms, who were late and just didn't show, or else I would not have had this problem. So they eventually got there like a minute before it started, and then Mike Pearson's mom was so horrified by what we were watching, and all three of my other friends were so upset that she was like, I'm not going to make anybody who's not my own child go, but I don't want Mike to watch the rest of this. I think it was the Coke bottle scene that
Oh,
finally.
but that's like near the
I know, like they stuck it out for so long, right? But she was like, Mike and I are leaving. Anybody else who wants to come, I will take you home now. And Mandy Crabtree and whoever the other person was also followed her to the car. I was like, fuck that, y'all are waiting for me.
I want to
So
see a
I.
docu I want to see a documentary about this event.
Yeah, seriously.
It was amazing. And like, I didn't even really understand what she was doing with the Coke bottle. And now when I rewatch it, I'm sure there were many things I didn't totally understand. But I basically like gave her a version of the like creative liberty speech that Madonna gives to the Detroit or the Toronto police, I guess. It's like it's very important that we stand here for all of her artistic expression. So anyway, that was the first time I saw it. And then I've seen it a few times since, and most recently when I taught this class about the movies of 1991 to freshmen, whenever that would, like 2009, I guess.
It's so cool how certain movies people always remember the circumstance in which they saw them.
How did the college students of 2009 take this movie? I'm always fascinated by hearing about what your classes think about these movies.
Well, Madonna's such a completely different figure to them now,
Yeah.
and like they're in general pretty wrapped up in the there's this old lady who's trying to hold on to her celebrity reading of
Right.
her. And they kind of know the music right before this movie better, like Holiday and Lucky Star, and
Right.
so they thought it was like they were into the like refusing of the police and whatever, but as a documentary, I think in the ways it's influential, it's now a little bit easy to take for granted. So they,
They took it for granted a little bit.
well, they took a little, yeah, they were interested in it, but they quickly they moved on to Terminator 2 quite happily. But Nathaniel, how did you first see it?
Well, I also saw it overseas, weirdly enough. Since I'm the oldest one on this podcast, I was on my mission for the Mormon Church. And
You guys have such better stories than me, man. This is great.
we've got the army and the Mormon Church already in effect. This is
Seriously, I've got Catholic repression that kept me from seeing it till my
good
20s. That's
point.
great.
So I was sort of like a famously like too worldly missionary, you know, so everybody knew that I was obsessed with Madonna, and that's like not cool among missionaries, of course, because I had a comforter which I bought in Norway that was Madonna's face. My entire like bed was covered with Madonna's face.
Sorry. That's so great.
So this, like, what this, you know, news spread very quickly because that's a very heathen thing to do as a missionary. So I slept with Madonna every night, right? So,
right.
So the word spread quickly. I was at some sort of meeting, so a bunch of guys ran up to me who also liked Madonna, and we're like, "Oh my God, have you seen?" Or "Oh my goodness," or whatever they said, non-Mormon, non-swearing.
My stars!
Oh my heck! Yeah.
Yeah. So they were like, "Have you seen Truth or Dare?" And I was like, "No." And they're like, "You have to go. It is so amazing." So all these like missionaries were telling me, even though missionaries aren't allowed to see movies, people were going to movies. So I went to it, and
she would support you, I'm sure,
and loved every second of it. And surprisingly, like, my missionary companion at the time was very, very sort of like conservative Southerner, and he totally was, you know, loved it too, even though he wasn't really a Madonna person. I think people don't remember how like new it felt in every way.
Yeah.
Back then, because people just didn't do that. I mean, like, this, I'm sure this is a big topic of discussion for if you want to put it in context, but this is even before MTV's The Real World. So,
yeah.
The whole, like...
Joe, have you seen that show?
Once or twice, yes. Yeah.
So this, the whole, like, you know, show everything about your life, like, the narcissistic, you know... This is me.
Right.
It's before selfies, before like any of that. And she was, and I remember at the time there were so many articles about like, what is she doing? Because part of the whole celebrity thing is how mysterious and enigmatic celebrities are to us. And
right,
she's demystifying it, so it's going to ruin everything, you know.
And because her celebrity was so understood as being about, you know, constant kaleidoscopic reinvention, and so it seemed like off-brand in some way to demystify herself, right?
Yes.
If that's what was going to happen, even though it doesn't really seem like it's what happens.
But that's why also that, like, the Warren Beatty scene has always been the most sort of fascinating and telling scene about the movie, where he's, you know, she's having the throat examination, and he's just so incredulous about the whole project, and it's such a like sign of the times. I can't imagine, speaking of like your college students, Nick, like that's got to play so differently now, because it's like, what is he even talking about? Like, she's having a throat exam on camera. She's, you know, it's one of the, you know, least invasive things you could possibly do on camera now. And but back then it was such a, you know, huge changing of the guard celebrity wise, where he represented that kind of old guard and couldn't possibly understand why you would put yourself out there on that level. Like, deeply, deeply doesn't understand. You can almost, I always say that, like, his relationship with Madonna and maybe even this film in particular is what, like, if that hadn't happened, he would not have, like, settled down with Annette Bening.
Right.
Because, like, this movie really sort of, like, scared him straight a little bit, and the relationship with Madonna, because it was just sort of like, oh, right, like, I, you know, this is the way celebrity is now. Time to, you know, settle on down. But I always, like, that scene always, like, blows me away when I watch it.
Yeah, I mean, that scene is, like, sort of like a, it's like begging to have, like, thesis papers written about it.
Yeah.
Because he's just, like, boldly stating this.
The thesis?
And the ideas about what celebrity means and what it doesn't and what privacy means. And it's, like, all that stuff is, like, in that one little scene.
Yep.
And which is,
and yet, when I was 13, I totally failed to recognize him. Like, I wouldn't have had that much context except for the cover of I'm Breathless to even know what Warren Beatty looked like. So I was just like, I'm not even going to totally double down that I understood that they were together. Like, I was kind of, I was a little confused and so hypnotized. I was just like, why is this old man being so weird to her? Like, she should, what a drag.
They do kind of tap dance around that, you know, that relationship, or at least, you know,
well,
stands away from saying it explicitly.
Well, I'm sure it's because he didn't want to be on in it at all.
Right.
Exactly. Like, I mean, like, the first scene with him is also fascinating in that he doesn't say anything.
He doesn't say anything.
Right. Like, they keep really showing him, and he's just resisting being a part of it.
Yeah.
And yeah, he won't even, like, approach the foreground of the shot.
Right. And I also...
And again, and this isn't, like, some, like, shrinking Violet of his day. Like, Warren Beatty was the sort of, like, cad playboy of his era, and... But it was, again, such a different era that, like, for, you know, being outrageous then and being outrageous in the 90s was two totally different things.
Right. And
although he was pretty famously interview averse. Like, there was that time he went on Barbara Walters and kind of wouldn't answer any of her questions. So in a way, it is, like, so hypocritical and also kind of who he was, but so different from what she's begging for.
Yeah.
And I also, like, in addition to that, the changing of the guard, it's also a great time capsule just in terms of celebrity in general.
Totally.
But I wonder, like, how people today take it, because there are so many celebrities in it. Some not even named that you just see in the background. But,
like Olivia Newton-John, like, I know who you're thinking about.
Yeah, like Olivia Newton-John, but also Matt Dillon's in it, very briefly. Yeah. And so there's all these, like, people, and I wonder how, like, for younger people who watch it, if they even know that these are famous people. Like, in the background of so many shots, you know?
Right.
I definitely remember some chuckling about, you know, at Kevin Costner's expense.
Oh, God, that's the best, too. Good Lord.
And also, the, like, who's Antonio Banderas?
Oh, God.
I love that they, like, spell his name wrong in the movie.
Sorry?
They spell his name wrong in the movie.
Yeah, they spell it wrong. She says it wrong. He's in all the Ottavar movies, you know, whatever. But, but everybody else, I think, was kind of off their radar. Certainly Sandra Bernhardt. I mean, forget it. But
yeah.
Except that one kid. And I was like, we can have the conversation later. And I mean the conversation.
Except what one kid?
That one kid who, you know, has already seen Without You, I'm Nothing, and can identify Sandra Bernhardt despite being born in, you know.
Oh, right.
I'm like, I see what's going on here. Yeah, I'll be in my office.
I hear that dog whistle. Okay. Yeah.
Well, the thing with the Sandra Bernhardt scene, too, is that the funny thing about that scene is you have... You know, we're talking about Madonna just, like, displaying her whole life, but there's this weird thing in the scenes with Warren and with Sandra, basically, only, because the other celebrities are just cameos, but where they're not sure how much they're going to be involved in it, and, like, Sandra doesn't use the pronoun when she's talking about her girlfriend.
Yeah.
Until, like, halfway through the scene, and then they give up, and then they start whispering it, and then they just give up, and... So Sandra was, like, basically coming out during the documentary.
So was she not out before that?
I don't really totally remember, but it's just funny because when they approach it, she says, "this person." And then they start whispering her, you know?
Yeah.
And then they just come right out and say, well, she'll have fucked you over by the time this comes out. So right. Then they just give up
right.
the pretense of it. But it's just so such a weird scene in terms of celebrity and the LGBT awareness and all that.
Yeah. It's a very interesting movie to watch on an LGBT level because of that and because of the thing with the dancers and how... I remember the first time I watched the movie and I was just like, those girls are nasty. Like, then they're so, like, they're so set up as this sort of, like... you know, pack of hyenas for the other one. And yet it's also incredibly, like, you know, it's humanizing in a way that movies back then weren't really, and it was showing, you know, actual real people, and it wasn't, these were the kinds of things you weren't really getting a window into back then, especially if you, you know, weren't into the subculture enough to even, like, know what Paris is Burning was, which
right.
is, like, I mean, that's a whole other kettle of fish, too, with, like, you know, Madonna and gay culture and drag culture. But, like, this is another sort of example of her kind of ushering that culture further into the mainstream than it would have been at the time.
I think because people take, like, Wikipedia and IMDb and all of these ways in which movies are referenced, people don't really understand the timing of them. Because
right.
Paris is Burning, people think of it as coming before Truth or Dare, but it actually opened after Truth or Dare.
But well, also right. Premiered earlier, because it had played at Sundance.
Yes, exactly, but like people in general had not seen it when Truth or Dare came out.
Right.
And so they were both like these, like it was a really good year for LGBT documentaries, and then of course Oscar ignored both of the films, even though they were like basically the most talked about documentaries that year. Because they both came out in the
same Oscar.
Because they both came out in the summer of '91.
Yeah.
But with Madonna's movie first, even though it's obviously they're such great companion documentaries because you see like some of the I think it gives you more context for the worlds that like Jose and Luis and Slam and all those people were coming. Well, not Slam, but Jose and Luis and Gabriel and all the worlds that those people were coming from, because Madonna keeps referencing their poverty and that they haven't ever seen anything, and you know the fact that it's a racially diverse movie because of the dancers,
right?
It's super interesting in a time capsule way. And of course, then there's the Truth or Dare scene, which has the longest gay makeout I'd ever seen in a movie.
Oh, yeah. That's very true. That's definitely very true.
Which was, in fact, I think that even though there was the like mass exodus from my social group about the Coke bottle, I think it was the kiss that actually triggered it. I mean, it's all the same scene, you know, but
right.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And I think, we were talking about how it sets up the queen, I guess the mean girls of the piece were Slam, Jose and Luis. But what I think is so interesting about that scene is even though it sets them up, not the Truth or Dare scene, but earlier when they're ganging up on Oliver, is that it's portraying them as sort of the mean girls, but then when Madonna comes out to give them the speech, her like sort of talking, her lecture to them is actually honoring their strengths.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, she's not sort of, I think she's also being... Yeah, I think she's also being very careful. I think that by that point, she'd already sort of talked to... she had narrated a little bit about how she was worried she was sort of losing control of the tour because they were in New York and she wasn't staying with them. She was staying at her own place. And I think you could see her being sort of careful not to... She doesn't want to alienate all the other dancers by making it look like she's favoring one. Mm-hmm. But you're right, she's also very, like... he doesn't have the self-defense mechanisms that you guys have, developed over your lives. And I was like, I always thought that was a very interesting thought that I never really had given, a ton of thought to. That sort of that idea that, like, these boys were strong because of the, the armor that they'd built up for themselves.
So for those who are not aware, a bunch of the dancers from Truth or Dare star in a new documentary called Strike a Pose, which I don't think it has distribution yet, but it's gotten a ton of press coverage, and they sort of are following or revisiting them now 25 years later to see what their lives are like. A lot of them are dance instructors now, for example, and they're dealing with what it was like in the shadow of that movie, because like I think that's an interesting thing about the documentary. It's really like an ensemble documentary in some ways.
I mean, kind of. Yeah, I mean, it is. And I remember thinking that, like, her... Since I was a pretty, enough of a fan that I was dressing up as her for Halloween on a Marine Corps base, right? Like, that, I'll put some things on the line for this woman. But but it was like, completely filtered through the music. And I wasn't... I would not have known who these people were. Like, I was recognizing people from her videos and stuff, like Donna and Nick, but I didn't know them. But so I was really struck by getting some exposure to both like that professional circle and also seeing her brothers and her dad and all, but her grip on the movie is pretty intense, and her own discomfort in moments of like wanting to all the talk about wanting to mother everybody or wanting to do this on behalf of the group, but then really needing it to be about her also, was, I thought, interesting at the time, and even in some ways even more interesting now, just because You know, I don't think like generosity or group dynamic is what follows her around as a star text these days.
Right.
And so just trying to, you know, I think it's an interesting document about like having been that kind of unprecedented and enormous a celebrity as a woman at that time. And, you know, I don't know that like nice person is in the top 10 things I would say about her, but it's not untrue, but it is complicated and it's not clear how important that is. You know, like, and I remember being really influenced by that about her, maybe positively and negatively, but I just thought about it a lot, like that she wasn't particularly endearing of herself. And to see scenes like finding out that what's the woman's name has been sexually assaulted.
I was just about to bring that up. Makeup
she's
artist.
Like, I bet that guy found out she worked for me. It's like, honey, whoa. Yeah. She's laughing, you know.
Making it about herself, yeah.
Yeah, and apologizing about laughing, and it's a weird moment, but you mentioned warts and all before.
Well, that's the thing that I sort of find most fascinating about the movie. Like, that one part, the fact that, you know, to whatever degree of control she had over it, that stayed in the movie, and it makes her look so bad. But you wonder whether that's an act of ego or whether that's an act of, like, you know, artistry, where she's just like, well, I did it, like, you know.
Yeah.
But it's always been one of the most fascinating parts about that movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I find it totally endearing about the movie is that you can see her, and I think this speaks to why she's not a good actor. You can totally see those moments where she's being completely real, and those moments where she's like editing herself or realizes that she's just done that on camera.
Yeah.
Which is fun, I think, for somebody that you think of as just living for the camera, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it also speaks to why she's never relaxed as an actor. But I also think, like, I hate the ageism that surrounds her nowadays. Just hate it.
Right.
But there is something about this movie and how fun her brattiness is that I don't think is endearing in older people. But at the time, she had just turned 30. She was this, like, the diva, you know, who has her, you know, entourage of fun dancers, you know. And I think it plays, like, the bitch I'm Madonna is like, in many ways, like, a sequel to that. But it doesn't play the same way.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's partly about age, and it's partly just about level of success in a way, right? That like, we are watching her both be a kind of global celebrity in this movie, but also still, in a way that's worth defending, having to really fight for every inch she's getting, you know? And, like, there was that sense that, you know, this is the hardest part to evoke to my students, is just the internet not existing, and what the celebrity apparatus even was. But the sense that she was in the headlines all the time, but kind of, you know, in this way that it felt like it could be taken away from her at any moment. You know, like, the Vatican might shut her down, or his parents' rights groups might shut her down, or but
the fascist state of Toronto, of all places.
The fascist state of Toronto. And then and so it's just interesting what happens when, by the time she is, like, totally ensconced, but rather than kind of easing up on that stuff, you know, it plays differently now.
Yeah.
As you said.
It's also interesting to me, but there's no really context for it in the movie, that sex came right after this.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of a natural sequel in some ways into what she was doing that nobody else was doing. The sort of, here is just me, like, I'm not going to self-censor, even though there is self-censoring happening. And yet, people did not find that endearing.
Well, the thing about sex that was always so interesting was that it seemed like it was provocation without a ton of focus. In that it was just sort of like it was called sex because it was just sort of like, well, we, like, there was nothing more narrow to talk about. You know what I mean? So it's just like it was her sort of taking that provocation to its, like, natural end, but didn't have some of the pointedness that I feel like you see on a lot of the stuff in the Blonde Ambition tour. And the parts of the tour that we see in Truth or Dare all seem very, like, I almost wanted to see a little bit more of that in terms of, like, what went into the conception behind each number, because they all seem very, you know, thought out and with a sort of concept behind each scene. And seeing them is very interesting. But I almost wanted to see, like, hear more from Madonna about how she sort of developed that stuff. Not that everything else in the movie isn't fascinating, because it totally is.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of it in terms of, like, its documentary form? Like, somebody assembling it from hundreds of hours of footage, do you think it's... Like, obviously, Madonna isn't... She's performing, but is she really the author, you know?
Mm. Well, one thing I never noticed until this time, or if I had, I'd forgotten, was that it's edited by Barry Alexander Brown, who's Spike Lee's editor. And and it's not bad as a sort of Spike Lee movie, you know, like that it has a sort of obvious center, but is constantly in this, like, centrifugal moving away from its own center and finding all these other revolving centers all the time. So it's clearly her, but it's also the entourage, and it's also the controversy, and it's also the mother narrative that just keeps coming back. And the cutting really does kind of keep you on your toes a little bit, that it doesn't, it's not like one clean arc in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked that about it a lot, and that did sort of speak to, like, the sense that you're hearing from people. I think the movie embodies that she really is interested in other people's creativity, even if at a certain moment it has to be kind of subordinated to hers or incorporated into hers.
Mm-hmm.
But that does feel like the movie I would expect him to cut together. It's hard to say about Kashishian, because short of With Honors, mm-hmm. I don't know what else we have to compare it to. But.
Right. I'm glad I didn't even realize that he had edited that. That's interesting.
And also interesting in just the whole, like, people talk about Paris is Burning, but that's also showing you again that she is kind of a cinephile and really interested in sort of New Yorkers of color and new independent movements, and that of course she'd be like a Spike Lee fan, right? Or
mm-hmm.
I mean, if not assuming she'd be the person hiring, but also not assuming anybody gets past her without, you know, her input.
Yeah.
It was interesting to me in the movie that when the tour goes back to New York, that's when she most sort of cocoons herself, which, and then part of that is circumstantial, because she had been so, you know, she'd had been having such, like, health problems with the throat, and she had to really rest it, but also in terms of the greater kind of Madonna narrative, is at this point that her celebrity has prevented her from sort of engaging with New York in the way she used to, and engaging with sort of the scene in the way she used to, and then, you know, now it's, you know, she's Madonna, and in all the ways that isolates her and sort of keeps her in her little, you know, kingdom,
mm-hmm.
queendom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's fun to think of her New York history with it, because when she has that scene when she to this one for Keith, which is one of the most moving parts of the movie, I think, because there's everything about that little prayer there. Even though some of the prayers feel very performed, that one feels very honest to me.
Mm. Now, who was that for? Because I didn't
Keith Haring, the artist.
Okay, really dumb, so I don't know who that is.
Oh, a very, very famous artist who died of AIDS.
Gotcha.
So, if you saw...
You'll know him from the kind of pop prints with these really thick black line sort of outline figures.
Yeah, his work is still all over the place.
I'll look it up and I'll go... I always hate that I, like, reveal myself to be such, like, a uncultured dummy when it comes to, like, gay shit from the 80s, but anyway...
I mean, the interesting thing about that moment to me is remembering that, you know, obviously I really wasn't culturally aware of the early 80s in New York when I was younger, but so many people who were in those circles became famous. And there's so many other instances of that in culture, you know, where a bunch of authors come up at the same time, or a bunch of artists, or and I always find that so interesting. Like, there's so many like East Village personalities from that time, and Madonna lived on, you know, in Alphabet City, and that's just fascinating to me.
Well, at least comforts me now that when I Google his work and I'm looking at it, I do recognize all of this stuff. So, yes.
Well, and I had taken this one trip back to the U.S. during those years when I was living in Germany for this math contest, whatever. And the friends I was staying with in D.C., the family friends, took me to the National Portrait Gallery, which had an Annie Leibovitz show up. This was in May of '91, and she has that famous portrait of Keith Haring, who has painted his own naked body the way that he painted. You know, so he's all like white
Oh, I love that.
paint
I love
in
that
that white
photograph.
room. Yeah, amazing, right? And I thought the image was so striking, and of course I thought that this like naked guy was, you know, it was activating all the stuff it would when you're 13 and whatever. And so I, of course, in the way that you like glean, you know, had like saved that name in my mind to like find out who that is later. And I saw this movie, like, it took things a little longer to get to Germany, so I think it was the fall, but you know, 6 months later I find out he's already dead. So that was the first time that I, you know, found out about an AIDS death. And I think it was around the time that Magic Johnson's news was hitting the world, and on an army base that was, you know, off the charts in terms of sort of local impact. But the Keith Haring thing really is what stuck with me.
Yeah, it's just Madonna, like, I don't, younger LGBT people, like, I think they sometimes don't, like, everybody knows she's a famous gay icon, but I don't think people realize how connected she was to that community from the very, very early, before she was famous, you know. Any other observations? We should wrap up.
Well, I guess we haven't really talked about its status as a kind of dossier on the Like a Prayer album, which, you know, the videos and the songs were already 2 years old by the point this movie came out, but I don't. I mean, you might disagree, Nathaniel. Like, I don't feel like she made a lot of other albums that I really like a lot, but in terms of just a different kind of self-exposure or complexity in the songwriting or the things that she's tackling and willing to make, like, avowedly radio pop music about this stuff, I felt like she never went as far as that album. And to sort of see all this context for who she is and the different personas she's keeping in balance, so that some things on that album, like Oh Father, that already announced that something complicated is emerging in that song. But even things like Keep It Together, that feel a little bit more just like pop radio hits, take on a lot of resonance, and you kind of get a sense of what those songs mean to her. And it's just such an incredible album, that to have this document of things, this document to put with it.
It does seem like it happened at exactly the right
I
time
was just
for
gonna say that. Because afterwards, even when she, like, I personally think Ray of Light is her best album, but it was the exact right time for when she was the most exciting to watch as a person. Like, she had the most humor and the most complications, and she also didn't have some of the baggage that comes with getting older, like becoming a mother, like all of these things that have made her in a way more cocooned, actually. And with celebrities, it's always a danger that they become isolated because they're drawing from, it's the same way with like famous actors too. That you sense that you can sense it if they only have paid staff around them and whether they're engaged with the world, you know. It was the perfect timing, this documentary, because it was in many ways her artistic peak, like the late 80s and the early 90s. Even though she had other peaks, like I think
Oh,
Confessions on
totally.
a Dance Floor is amazing. But yeah, this was like the perfect moment for this.
Is it worth talking about at all, the fact that this was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Actress, and how that's, like, the epitome of everything that's awful about the Razzies?
like, it really... It.
It's just, like, it's so petty. It's such, like... With the greatest due respect, Nathaniel, I do find sometimes that Madonna fans can feel a little persecuted, like, in terms of the way they talk about Madonna, but, like, this certainly, like, feeds into that. Like, what, you know, this would not, you know, you wouldn't be cutting down somebody this sort of famous if they weren't a, you know, female musical artist of her stature. It's, I don't know, that felt gross, that Razzie nomination.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of things about... the public response to her feel gross to me, but yeah, I get what you're saying. The reason that people get very defensive who followed her career for a long time is that we've been seeing it from day one. Like, you guys were mentioning earlier that there was this, or Nick, you were mentioning earlier, there was this sense that at any moment it could all be taken away from her, and that was very true, because even after, like, the mega success of Like a Virgin, which was not her first hit, she... there was still all this, oh, she's a one-hit wonder. Like, after her, like, third massive success, people were still saying she was a flash in the pan. And it's like...
Or that it was, like, all down to Jelly Bean Benitez, and without him, she'd be nothing. And, yeah, right.
So this has been going on since the beginning, this, like, wanting her to fall off her pedestal. And there was, like... there's only been very rare times where people have mostly praised her. Otherwise, it's been people wanting her to fail.
Yeah. Well, and she sort of exists at the confluence, too, of, like, you know, she's pop music, she is an artist with such a huge visual component, and those things have always felt like they're sort of sniffed at by people who, you know, talk about music specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, too, that since I had... I'd never seen Purple Rain until this week, and just saw it on Wednesday in the theater, and I'm going back to see it again in an hour.
Oh, wow.
I can't find a word, but to see that sort of self-portraiture of Prince, but through a, you know, loosely ginned up fictional story, but all the ways in which it's digging into everything that is brilliant about his art and complicated about his persona. It's interesting seeing that he would go for that kind of loosely fictionalized story to do, I think, some of the same work that this does in a documentary, which now can feel like a more obvious way to have done it. But documentary was so not on the commercial map or anything it really was like 10 more years before there started being documentaries that were as culturally visible as the hit ones are now.
Yeah.
But also to realize, like, I didn't really think much until Prince died, and I read at places that for all that he was such a spectacle maker and a spectacle himself and a visual thinker, he didn't really make videos. And the ones that he made were often pretty spare.
Yeah.
It's not what you would expect. And so to see her have made such a reputation through video after video after video, they just weren't like each other, but every one felt like this really intense statement, especially at this point in her career. So that to be interesting on a movie screen meant to do something really different, whereas he can kind of finally make a video, in a sense. I think that that those two movies together are really speaking to each other in a heady way to me right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking him a lot this week, but since it was also the time to discuss this movie, and it's so strange that trinity of rock gods from that were all born that summer in 58, that she's the only one standing.
Well, and it's funny to think about Madonna and Prince in context of Michael Jackson, too, because what you were just saying about the similarities between Madonna and Prince in terms of their own image and sort of how they projected that, and that Michael Jackson was just the complete polar opposite of all of that, and that everything, all of his imagery seemed like obfuscation and sort of putting up that sort of wall of spectacle, but in a way that never really, you never really felt like you were getting down to Michael ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Yeah,
the sort of art of the self is a really interesting conversation with those people, because all three did it so differently.
Yeah.
And yet they were all like contemporary.
But that's what makes
Titans.
Truth or Dare very interesting too, is because you get the sense that like that both Madonna is revealing so much of herself and yet is so very much in control of her narrative, and like she's, you know, you're not getting anything that she doesn't want you to get.
Mm-hmm. Except for that adjustment.
And friends with that weird lady who made her a painting.
I cannot tell you how many times like my group of friends have quoted moments from that movie, including like "Love You Too" as we run around corners and don't look back. Because it's the most dismissive, disingenuous thing in the movie, I think. It's just so funny. Yeah. It's so funny to me.
Like, well, and Moira is one of the great, like, horror movie creations of the last, like, 30 years, right? Like, that whole scene, you're just like, no! Oh my god!
Yeah, don't let yourself become the brunt of this joke.
No. And but, don't get pregnant last week because you know that you'll have a chance to possibly ask her again.
Honest to God, the calculatedness of that is astoundingly frightening.
Just amazing. I'm going to need time to think about it. Honey, she's not thinking about it. Just as long as we're all clear about that. Like,
oh, God.
Okay, you guys, this is really fun.
Yay!
For those who have never seen it, because like, as I've learned this week, a lot of people have only seen parts of it. Which is also true of me and Purple Rain. Confession.
It's true of me and Purple Rain.
I've only seen certain scenes. I've never seen it all the way through. Yeah. But Nick is telling me it's great. So I had always heard it was okay. But the album's like, genius.
And like seeing it in a big crowded theater where people are whooping it up while also totally respecting it, like it couldn't get better. So I'm hoping to have that experience again today.
Well, I just noticed it's playing at the theater here. I didn't know that they were replaying it, but it is. So
yeah.
I might go. Anyway, if you haven't seen it, Truth or Dare is streaming on Netflix, so it's very easy to watch. So have at it.
Do it. Yep.
Thanks, Saul. Keep it together.
Thank you. Yes.
In the family.
Forever and ever.
Holiday.
This has been a reminder of your history.
Bye.
Signing off the ghosts of gay past. Yes.